Blog Talk Radio. I would like to welcome everyone to our first episode of Gear Talk on John Talk Radio. This will be a lot of fun. My guest tonight is Tom Guerra. You can visit Tom's website, tomguerra.com. His latest album is Trampling Out the Vintage. Highly recommend it. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be here.
You know, just listening to that song, and tonight, just to tell the listeners out there, we're going to do a couple of things tonight. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to take a look at Howlin' Wolf's 1963 Stratocaster guitar, its journey through life. Tom is the owner of one of Howlin' Wolf's guitars, this 1963 Stratocaster, which is currently on loan to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which has just got to be a cool thing in itself. And we're going to look into that and talk a little bit about Howlin' Wolf tonight, because this is his birthday, isn't it, Tom?
Yes, it is. He would have been 107 years old today.
You think he'd be rocking if he was still alive?
He definitely would be. I mean, and if he was still alive, I think the rest of the world would have caught on, too.
You know, it's something...
I would hope he would be a multi-billionaire, too, because of his influence.
Yes, absolutely. But I don't know if that would have been the truth, because a lot of times these guys just don't get their dues. And especially the roots, the guys that had the roots of blues music and country music and bluegrass music and all and all these different roots music that happened and made American music great, and actually made the British invasion music great, because they tried to copy a lot of that.
But, absolutely. And I mean, if you listen to what Hubert Sumlin was playing on this, on that last track, Killing Floor, I mean, that was 1964. Hubert had been with Howlin' Wolf for 10 years, but the tracks, the licks that he played on that track were used by everybody. I mean, you know, you could take Eric Clapton, Page, Beck, all of them, you know.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, when you listen to that recording, and one thing we want to talk about today is, like, the finished product, Tom, that we hear as the listener, like, you know, as John Doe and Jane Doe listen to a record and what we hear. One of the things that I want to talk about is how that you capture in the recording studio, or whether it's live or what we just listened to, the real essence of the music, the purity of it, without, you know, being, how do I say it, without it being overproduced or made perfect.
Yeah.
Because I hear a lot of that today, Tom. I hear a lot of music that just sounds great, but it lacks soul and depth. What do you think of that?
That's right. I agree, and I think the tools we have available today facilitate perfection, which can be very, very boring. The tools they had to in the old days, obviously they're using a reel-to-reel, a two-track, later a four-track, and so on. A lot of times they wanted to capture the first or second take. So there may be imperfections in there, but that gives a lot of this music its richness and its greatness, you know.
Exactly. So when this the song we just heard was a live recording, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think everything they did was technically a live recording too, because I don't think there was a lot of overdubbing going on. But yeah, that was Hubert playing his famous little Killing Floor licks on Howlin' Wolf's great track.
Now, when you hear this, when you listen to this, and what are some of the things that stand out with you as being a guitarist and being somebody who has produced and been in the studio? What are some of the things that you hear, Tom, that you think, man, if we could just get back to that?
Well, with somebody like Wolf, obviously the vocals and the lyrics are just,
and
you know,
the vocals are incredible.
It was about the sound. It was about the song. And the guitar player was playing a support role, rightly so, because it was about the song. And I think we did, after people realized that the blues was a great bed for soloing over, it kind of got bastardized to the point where, oh, yeah, let's do a blues song. And then next thing you know, somebody's on their sixth verse of solo. And I think it sort of corrupted the blues a little bit. So you listen to the early Muddy stuff, the early Wolf stuff. A lot of them were 2.5, 3 minute songs, and they were great because everything was there. You know, you had some great bass, you had great drums, and of course with Wolf's vocals, I mean, he just sounded like the devil or something, you know.
You know, I just love his vocals. There's something so real about it. It's like somebody, I don't know if this makes sense or not, Tom, but it's like you could meet him and talk to him and he could just, he wouldn't be a set offish. He would just be a person. And I don't know that many stories about him, but he just has that feel about it with his vocals that this isn't something that he's just making up. This is real stuff.
Absolutely. That's really what it comes down to, is reality, authenticity. And that's what made these guys great. And I would, again, this is not to disparage anybody that came later, but when I listen to the blues, I love listening to Wolf and Muddy and the first Cats, you know?
Yeah. And that's like the ground floor, the roots of it. And then it breaks out into a lot of stuff. And I enjoy a lot of things, too. I think the Electric Flag did a nice version of Killing Floor, if I'm not mistaken.
Great version, yeah.
Yeah, that was really nice. But let's talk about this guitar, Tom Guerra. Let's talk about this Stratocaster that came into your life. And if you believe in you know, things just happen for a purpose, but how did you first know about this guitar, and how did you meet it, and how did you purchase it? Tell us the whole story about that.
Sure thing. It was about 17 years ago, and you and I talk quite a bit, John, and you know I'm kind of a guitar freak, and I'm always looking for old guitars, and I came across one advertised for sale outside of Chicago. It was very, very beat up 1963 Stratocaster. And that to me, I've always had sort of a soft spot for 63 because it was the year I was born, but also it was a great period for Fender Stratocasters. And so long story short, I bought the guitar. As soon as I got the guitar, I found something on the pick guard that was kind of interesting and telling. It looked like at one point it had the words Lil Bill painted on the pickguard. And it must have been done with sort of one of those, you know, some sort of caustic paint that sort of etched itself in, because whoever added after Lil Bill, you know, removed it, but there was sort of a burn into the pickguard. So I think it was fingernail polish or something like that. So just for the heck of it, I Googled, you know, this is kind of the early days of Google. I Googled Lil Bill and the word guitar, and I found a picture of an old bluesman playing a newer guitar, but with Lil Bill in the same spot on the pick guard.
Wow.
And his name, Lil Bill Wallace was his name. His actual real name was Alex Wallace, but he went by Alex Lil Bill Wallace. He was in Mississippi, and, you know, I did some research on this guy and found out he was living, still alive, so I contacted him where he was living and, you know, talked to him a little bit, said, I found this guitar, I said Lil Bill on it, he said, and we talked a little bit about the guitar. So he didn't know, he said, send me some pictures. So I sent him pictures, U.S. mail. So I called him about a week later. He said, that is absolutely my guitar.
Oh,
so
wow.
So glad you found it. And the cool thing was, he's like, yeah, that guitar was mine for, you know, about 10 years. And I got that guitar from Howlin' Wolf.
So when he said so this, at that point, Tom, you're probably falling off your chair.
Well, I'm sort of a skeptical person, so, you know, I did know that Lil Bill, though, has a very interesting career. He was the guy who convinced B.B. King. B.B. King was going back and forth between gospel and blues, and Lil Bill convinced B.B. King to go headfirst into blues. Lil Bill was so popular in the Leland, Mississippi area in the early 50s, he actually got 2 recording contracts. And, of course, the record companies didn't know about each other. So he was blackballed for music. So,
oh wow.
he kept playing locally, and he also would book bands. And whenever Wolf would come to town, Bill would book him, and he'd stay at his house. They had a friendship. I was lucky enough to talk to Little Bill's son, whose name is Leo Smith, and he confirmed, yes, they were good friends. Yes, that was his guitar. And yes, it came from Howlin' Wolf. And I said, well, I always thought of Howlin' Wolf as the guy with a big, big, you know, a hollow body guitar. I'd never seen pictures of him. So there's a guy who wrote a great book on Howlin' Wolf, by the name of Mark Kaufman. I got in touch with him. He said, oh, absolutely, Wolf had a white Strat. And he sent me some pictures. And this was the moment that I really got the chill down my back. there's one very clear picture of Wolf playing the white Strat at a club in Chicago called Silvio's. And there was a big, big chip out of the lower bout of the guitar. So I got this photo, and I'm like, I can't wait to get home and look at the guitar. And I held the photo up to the guitar, and sure enough, with a lot of other chips, that distinguishing chip was right in the spot. At that point, I said, oh, man, this is big, you know? So I had the guitar for many, many years, and as you know, I write for Vintage Guitar Magazine, and right. They were always kind of bugging me to let's do a piece on the Wolf guitar. And I said, yeah, but I kind of want it to be honest, because I did have one find out about it. He came over my house and wanted to see the guitar, and the guitar wasn't in my house. So I Vintage Guitar published the piece. I was supposed to be a Northeast guitar collector and anonymous in it, but something got screwed up in the works. And I started getting emails from people saying, hey, great story on your Howlin' Wolf Strat. I said, how did you know it was mine? Because I hadn't got my issue yet. Like, oh, your name's throughout the whole thing. So I was like, oh, come on. You know, I was not a happy camper. So a couple of friends of mine, you know, kind of talked me off the ledge saying, hey, it's a cool thing. You know, people know you got the guitar. That's all right. So one of the folks who got in touch with me was the associate curator of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and she said, would you be interested in donating your guitar to the Hall of Fame? I said, well, as much as I love the Hall of Fame and that, I'm not donating a 63 Stratocaster.
I don't like it that much.
Yeah, right, exactly. So they said, well, we do have a 2-year loan program. And I said, well, that's great. I said, you know, I would like to take my family there. So if you can, you know, assure the guitar will be safe and, you know, get us passes, and which they did. And I said, I'm not shipping this guitar through UPS. So one night in February 2016, they said, we're going to send somebody to pick the guitar up.
Oh, wow.
I see an 18-wheeler art transportation truck coming down my street. they back up to the house. The entire truck was empty. They take the guitar, which was boxed and you know, double boxed and everything, put in the case, and they strapped it to the side of an empty 18-wheeler and drove it to Cleveland, Ohio that night.
That's awesome.
So, and yeah, and then about a month later, we took a trip there, and sure enough, it's right next to Muddy's red Telecaster and Freddie King's, I think it's 345 is there. Yes, 345 Gibson is there. So it's very, very, very cool that it's there. So that'll be there for just about another year. So if you're in Cleveland or close by, check it out.
Yeah, they've got some nice things there. I know people talk about, you know, Tom, this and that about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I really had a good time when I was there, and I enjoyed every second of it, and it brings back so many things. And one question I have is, when you said you were, you know, always constantly looking for guitars, and I totally get that, and you're a collector, and you're looking for the ones that would just stand out and have historic value. If not, now, if have you, let's just say a regular, normal 1963 Strat that's not that doesn't have any historic value to it, that's still got to be a pretty good find. If you can find one that's operating at that level, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah, and my main gigging guitar is another white 63 Strat, and it's a great. I've got it sort of very, you know, I got bigger frets I put in, so it's a little bit more modernly set up. So people are like, is that the Wolf? No, that's not the Wolf guitar, but you know, but yes. So any old pre-CBS Strats are very desirable guitars, and the pre-CBS is pre-1965, you know.
Now, when you got the Wolf Strat and you first got it, now, did they ship it to you, and did you go pick it up, or how did that work?
When I bought the guitar initially, it was just shipped to me. I'm on the East Coast, so it was shipped to me, and it's not really, you know. You know, I got the original case. I opened the case up. It smelled like tobacco and whiskey. And I am not kidding you. And it was, you know, the logo was almost all flipped off. The paint has just got sort of, you know, you imagine how somebody who smoked cigarettes for 50 years might look, their teeth might look. And that's kind of how the paint is yellowed and everything.
Now, did you leave it like that?
Oh, yeah, I've not touched the guitar. It probably could use a fret job. I did play it on one of the songs I played it on many songs in the studio, including one off Trampling Out the Vintage, my latest solo album, a song called Supermoon. And I played that guitar on it. It gets a real nice sort of that very sort of clear Strat sound on it, you know.
So yeah.
That's on Supermoon.
So did you get to meet Little Bill?
I never got to meet him, no. We talked several times, and then by 2008, I had gotten word that he had passed away. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a couple of his friends after he had passed away, and one of his friends is a pretty well-known Southern photographer by the name of Eufus Ruth, and he said that Bill was always happy that his guitar had been found, so that was a cool thing, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking about. I mean, I don't know the circumstances, you know, with what he had and what he did with the guitar and how it got into the hands of the people that you bought it from, but it's got to be one of those really cool things where he's thinking, I mean, if people out there can understand when you're a musician and you connect with an instrument, there,
yep.
It's hard to explain to somebody that's not a musician or that doesn't play for a living or doesn't, but especially in that genre of music, Tom, where it's the blues, and back in those days,
yep.
In the 50s, and when you were talking about it, it was, you know, it had the tobacco smell and the whiskey smell. I know it's just, to me that would be kind of cool because it would make you think about what it was like back then and what the,
oh,
it actually, yeah, it was like taken from a time capsule. I wonder
yeah,
where the guitar was.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just wondering how do
oh,
you
yeah.
think it was just in its case and somebody just sat it under a bed or something for a long time?
No, I don't, because it was not like that. So I know that Lil Bill also drove a beer truck, and he drove up to Chicago quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
And what we think, when I was talking to his son, he believed that on one of the trips north, he pawned the guitar.
Oh.
That was probably in the early, late 60s, early 70s. And the gentleman I bought it from had bought it at a garage sale in the early 70s from somebody who, from a woman who had thrown her husband out, basically. And this guy bought the guitar from. So we think that this guy bought it from the pawn shop after Lil Bill sold it. So,
now,
kind of
for the people, that's an awesome
yeah.
story. For people out
yeah.
there that look for treasure, and especially if you're a musician, if you're like Tom or like me, whenever I go to garage sales, I'm thinking, oh, please, let there be like a Rickenbacker under this person's bed for like 30 years.
Right.
And they just say, let's
yeah.
get rid of it today. And I just happen to pull up. And are there any other stories, Tom, as a guitar collector, like that you've anything close to the wolf guitar or anything like, because I think that would be one of the coolest things. I think estate sales are pretty good. I think garage sales are good because there's not a lot of, like, if you go to certain places, the guitar has gone through a lot of layers. People have looked at it, they priced it, the
Right.
price goes up. If it's in a garage, a lot of times people may not know exactly what it is, whether
That's
that's a
right.
good thing or not, but
Well, I think you had more of a chance to stumble across something like that pre-internet, because now everybody thinks they've got the Holy Grail because somebody's selling one on eBay for X amount of money, you know.
Oh yeah,
But in the old,
absolutely.
I've got a good friend of mine who found a pristine, you know, George Harrison Country Gentleman, I think a 64, at a tag sale, and the gentleman who sold it to him said, "I paid $325 for this in 1964, and I will not take a penny less than that." So,
Oh,
so he might have
wow.
bought that. But in terms of the guitars I have, that's by far the coolest story, probably one of the coolest guitars. I do have another Stratocaster that's a 1970, also a white one, that I bought from a friend of mine in Florida. And he, you know, I talked to him about a year later. He goes, "Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you, I got that from Greg Martin of the Kentucky Headhunters." So I know Greg, and I sent Greg a picture. He goes, "Oh yeah, I actually own that guitar twice, once in the 70s and once in the, I think in the 90s," he said too. So he sent me some pictures of him playing that guitar, which is a cool thing. So
Yeah,
that
that
was
is.
sort of another stumble on thing, you know. And
Yeah, that's.
I love the Stratocaster. To me is, you know, the perfect electric guitars. I mean, I just love everything about it, and my heroes have played them. You know, starting off as a kid when I really got into guitar, you'll hear in a minute about Rory Gallagher, and he was the one who got me into playing guitar and Strats, and that's kind of why I love the Stratocaster, because of players like Rory, you know, and Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, and it's one of those things. Now, one quick question, and then we'll take a music break, and then we'll get started on the Gallagher stuff. When you took your family to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and you saw a guitar, what tell us how that felt. That had to be kind of a really cool feeling.
I was more moved than I thought I would be, because it's in, when you walk into the Hall of Fame, the lowest level is the Roots of Rock and Roll section, and you walk in there, and it's basically like, you know, the first exhibit you see is Howlin' Wolf, and there's his guitar, and there's, you know, there's a little, a little plaque that, you know, courtesy of me on there. That
Oh,
part
that's
didn't
cool.
impress. But what impressed me was just the Hall of Fame with these guitars, with these old blues men being featured, just really, really like hit me in the gut. You know, it was an amazing thing, and it was a great thing. So.
And my guest is Tom Guerra. Are you still there, Tom?
Oh yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, good. You can go on Tom's website, which is Tom Guerra, GUERRA.com. I highly recommend purchasing his newest and his other solo CD, Trampling Out the Vintage. It's really good, well worth it. Great job there. Let's take a music break, and we'll be right back.
Sounds good.
Thank you. the desert sand. World was full of little 45s, save you from another man. A man lies about that, some of them cries about that, some of them dies about that. Everybody fighting about a spoon, a dead spoon.
And I want to welcome you back to John Talk Radio's Gear Talk with Tom Guerra. And we were talking about Howlin' Wolf's guitar, the 1963 Stratocaster that Tom is the owner of. And it's on loan at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. So it's a great place to go visit. Do you have any idea, Tom, what you're going to do with it when you get it back from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
You know, I'm definitely going to continue to play it, and I'm wondering if I should refret it or not. You know, if you really want to play this thing a lot, you're going to need to refret it, just because the frets are really the original frets and they're shot. But it's an original guitar, so I kind of go back and forth on that, and I may or may not refret it. I don't know, but I'm going to obviously hang on to it and keep playing it, keep recording with it.
Yeah, and I guess it's one of those things where with me, if I wouldn't even think about selling it if it was me. I don't know. So to me, I would want it to be – it's not like I would – you want to keep it at its historic value, but it's also way, way cool to be able to play it and to record on it.
Right.
So, yeah, I can understand that, how I would want to do that, because it would be – and this is how weird it would be for me. I would probably just go over and stare at it for a while. And like, well, think, oh my gosh, there it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's,
it's a cool guitar. And I'll tell you, it's, the pickups sound great still on there. And they're all stock, you know, everything's stock on there.
Now that's three pickups on that.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, and anything else you'd like to say about the guitar or Howlin' Wolf before we start talking about Rory Gallagher and his album Photo Finish?
No, but I would just say, you know, check out, if you're not familiar with Howlin' Wolf's music, check out, you know, there's a lot of great albums. There's, you know, if you want to kind of ease into Howlin' Wolf, there's one called The London Sessions, which have the Stones rhythm section, and Hubert Sumlin, thanks to Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton plays on it, and he said, I'm only playing on it if you bring Hubert in. So Steve Winwood plays on that too. But there's also a great album that Wolf released actually Chess Records released it in 1969, Howlin' Wolf Evil. And if you look on the back of that, there's the white Stratocaster. So that's always been one of my as well. Too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be really cool.
Yeah.
Well, now, this is our first episode of Gear Talk, so if anybody has any questions for Tom or if you'd like to call in, there's a toll-free number you can use, and it's 877-694-5613, and you can get in and we'll take your call. Now, as a musician, as a guitar player, a person that has a lot of history and a collector and has, you know, played a lot of guitar, Tom, we're going to talk about an album that you told me that was one of the biggest influences on you, and that is Rory Gallagher's Photo Finish. Now, why did this album, can you remember the first time you heard it, and why do you think that it affected you the way it did?
I can not only remember the first time I heard it, I can remember very distinctly how I got it, and I didn't buy it. At the time, you know, there were a lot of radio stations where you call in and win an album, little contests on radio stations, you know. So I had called and won an album. It was like a rock trivia thing. And I was, I think, let's see, I was 14, 15 years old. And I won an album, and they delivered it. It was Patti Smith's Horses, and which I later went on to really like. But at the time, I'm like, yeah, I'm not really into this. So there was a local record store that I went into and started looking for albums to sort of, you know, swap it with. And cause they would do that in those days, you know, oh, I got this, I don't like it, you know, regardless of the fact that I didn't buy it there. They're like,
right,
yeah, yeah, another album quality. So I saw this album cover with Rory Gallagher, and I had heard a lot of good things about him, never had heard any of his music. I said, oh, what the heck, it's not going to cost me anything. So I swapped it for Rory's album, brought it home, put on, you know, dropped the needle on the turntable, and lo and behold, Shin Kicker comes on. And it literally, I was reading every word on that album jacket like we used to, and heard side one, flipped it over, heard side two, and I was like, I got to hear this again. So I ended up listening to it three times that day because it was so damn good. And the more I listened to it, the more I just, his playing really, and his songs really spoke to me. And, you know, I knew he was playing a Stratocaster, and the sounds he was getting out of the Stratocaster just were gorgeous. And they were, getting back to our prior conversation at the beginning of the hour, they were very real. You know, you could hear little things like strings touching other strings that were not perfect, but they were so real. They just kind of grabbed me, and I've been a lifelong fan ever since.
That's a good story. I have a similar story to that with the Blues Magoos. I went to this department store in Columbus back in the 60s. This is somewhere in the mid to late 60s, and I was looking for a particular album, Tom. I can't remember what it was right now, and they didn't have it. So I just picked up this album. It was the Blues Magoos, and I had never heard of him. I didn't know anything about him. I thought, you know, it looks pretty cool, so I just bought it. And
it's
the same thing happened with me. It was like, wow, it was like rock and blues, and it was just real raw stuff, and I loved every bit of it. But when you were saying that, like one thing that I always think is interesting to talk about, you talked about the album cover, and you were looking through all these albums, and the album just kind of jumped out at you. You look at the cover. I mean, the cover is like a Rory playing the guitar, and he's you know, kind of different phases of him playing it, and
yeah.
And that in alone is really cool. What do you think in today's 2017, Tom, in our world today, that are we missing some of that? You know, some of this connection with the album, with the person. You said you read everything on the album. I mean,
I do
the same thing. I love that. I think I can remember sitting on the bus on the way home, reading every word of on the album. I didn't know, you know, who these people were, but it was so cool.
Well, back then, that was the only information we had, and that was worth its weight in gold. Today, all you got to do is go on Google or Wikipedia, and you can find out more than you ever wanted to find out. But in those days, we were hanging on every last word. You know, we loved it when the dust sleeves also had words or photos on there, you know, and just reading, you know, every single word, you wanted to know what was behind that. It was, I think it was a more holistic experience than just downloading an MP3 from iTunes, you know.
I think that, you know, a couple of things came to my mind when you said that. One is the fact that I totally agree with it. I love that investigating part of it. I love that, you know, you have to kind of look for it. And I can remember that. It was like back when I grew up and I would hear a great song, I had to stand by the radio and wait for it to come on. It was like there was no other way to hear it unless I could go in and get money. If I could collect somehow enough papers and I could, you know, do my paper route and I could get enough money and I could take a bus into Columbus, Ohio, and I could get their album, then I would just play it forever. But other than that, I just had to wait till it came on. Now, I think that's really cool. But plus the fact that it is, you got that. But then you got the fact that when you found that, you know, Howlin' Wolf's guitar, you were able to go on the internet and track down Little Bill. So that wouldn't have probably been, it would have been a lot harder if you wouldn't have had that.
You're absolutely right. Yep. So there definitely are trade-offs in terms of that, you know. And when I, you know, to that end, when I was talking to you and you said, I'd like you to come on and talk about, you know, a favorite album of yours, I used the internet to get in touch with Rory's brother, I talked to his brother. I talked to his drummer, Ted McKenna, and his bass player, Jerry McAvoy, and they gave me an entire picture as to what was going on with Rory when this album was recorded. So, again, never would have been able to do that without the internet. So, you know, we gain some things, we lose some things.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good pretty good time to be alive, but I really like that part too, because it's amazing to be able to reach out to people. And you know, I had a show, one of the shows I've done over 700 episodes, but one was with Homer Scarsborough, who was in Dixie, what was the guy's name? It was the Dixie Cats, and they were a band back in the 50s that toured.
Okay.
They were rockabilly band, and I just stumbled upon Homer, and I've had a couple of shows with him, got to know him, and all of the amazing things that happened. Sweetie Jones and the Dixie Cats, if you get a chance to look that up. Oh my gosh, it's such great stuff. But I would have never been able to do that, Tom, without the internet. But let's get into the album. So you if you want to talk about the first song you said that jumped out and got you was Shin Kicker. Let's play that, and then we'll come back, and then you can kind of share some of the things that Rory's bandmates and his brother can tell us about what was going on, because I know that the music is something that's incredible, but I always love knowing about the person, about what he was all about and what his life was about. And a lot of these guys had a hard time dealing, and I'm not sure about Rory particularly, Tom, but a lot of these guys back in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s had a hard time with fame, and they had a hard time with all of this things going on around their music. They were very artistic people, but they were private people. And a lot of times it was difficult for them to be in the limelight all the time. So we'll talk about that. My guest is Tom Guerra. We're talking about Photo Finish, the album from Rory Gallagher. We're going to play the Shin Kicker, and we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
Yeah. John? John? All right.
Pack my things and love and my bag. Toothbrush
John?